Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From right beside Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Harry Shearer. And it's a coincidental kind of week because, coincidentally, right at this moment, as we're broadcasting from New Orleans, back in Los Angeles, there is a meeting scheduled to begin. A last-minute, last-ditch mediation session between the writers and the producers before the strike gets called on Monday. And I believe we have a microphone in that negotiating room, so maybe we can just, can we just bring that up and see how that's going, how that negotiation's going? All right, so good progress so far. And other coincidence this week is that as I arrived back in the Crescent City, there were interesting news developments involving the city's two nationally best known nationally politicians, political figures. There's the case of Congressman William Jefferson, who is best known for being under indictment when the FBI found $90,000 in cash sequestered in his freezer. And, you know, he's been subjected to a lot of comic remarks since then, as well as some criticisms. But, you know, the freezer keeps him dry. You put him in the fridge and it's too humid. But anyway, this week we learned that the defense strategy in Jefferson's case is going to basically boil down to, among other things, whether when the FBI came to his door at 7 in the morning, whether, as they say, he was fully dressed and therefore up and ready for business, or whether, as he says, he had just thrown on a pair of trousers hurriedly without even doing what a guy does, a guy of his age, 59, when he wakes up in the morning, and that he wasn't allowed to visit the John for hours, including the time after the FBI read him his rights and started questioning him, and his attorney maintains that, therefore, he was under duress because a man of that age. So it becomes now a case of which is the crucial appliance, the fridge or the toilet. And the city's other best-known political figure, Mayor Ray Nagin, who is best known in New Orleans for not being around. It's an amazing city where if you want to call the mayor, you don't have to go through all the hassle of dialing City Hall and getting put through to different extensions and different offices. You just dial missing persons. But that skill proved useful this week. The district attorney in New Orleans has been under fire. Well, they're all under fire. All the politicians here. But he was under fire for the fact that as the crime rate spiraled, murder suspects were being let loose and never prosecuted. In one particularly prominent case, because the DA's office said the single witness, a lot of these cases I have only one witness, and she couldn't be found. At which point the police department waits about 18 hours and then says, oh, you mean this one? This witness right here that we just found? And here she is? And the DA's office was also under a federal judgment. About 38 former employees of the DA's office filed suit. They were white. The new DA was African-American. He fired them. They won a civil rights judgment, which now totals about $3 million, which he said, well, the city will pay that. And the city said, no. So this week, the mayor shared his powers of disappearance when he managed to persuade the district attorney to step down. So it can be it's a gift that can be transferred, and sometimes for the public good, as we found out. Ladies and gentlemen, better to be a chemical company than an airline passenger. That's all you can conclude from this. The Department of Homeland Security on Friday eased rules requiring tens of thousands of U.S. chemical plants to protect their stockpiles from terrorists. They eased the rules. It pleased chemical industry lobbyists, but disappointed environmentalists. The regulations touch a wide range of U.S. industry. The measure's been delayed for years by disagreements within the Bush administration over the need for new regulations after the 2001 terrorist attacks. Gee, I thought it was their first priority. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, yeah, he still has his job, described the rules as a critical piece of federal efforts to diminish the threat posed by large private stockpiles of dangerous chemicals. They proposed in April a list of 344 chemicals that businesses would have to track and disclose to the department through an online system. But under heavy criticism from chemical companies, the DHS has now released a less stringent version, reducing the number of targeted chemicals to 300 and raising the reporting threshold. One of the chemicals involved is chlorine. Insurgents in Iraq have used bombs that disperse liquid chlorine into toxic gas clouds, but that's Iraq. DHS also increased the disclosure threshold for ammonium nitrate by about a third. That substance was in the fertilizer-based bombs in Oklahoma City. We've tried to craft this regulation, says Christina McDonald of the Department of Homeland Security. We've tried to craft this regulation to capture both where we think the greatest consequence is and to reflect what is practiced in the industry and how it works. We tried to create a balance. Did they do that? Did the Homeland Security Agency try to create a balance when they rammed through that 3 ounces of stuff for people flying on airplanes? I don't think they did. I don't think they asked for comments either. Comments were hundreds of comments from the chemical industry. 4,400 comments from the chemical industry, most of them critical, which helped them achieve their balance. So, yes, better to be a chemical company than an airline passenger. Greeting the newly relaxed regulations as good news was Senator Joseph Lieberman, who's in the news in Connecticut because he received campaign contributions in his presidential campaign from garbage executive, indicted garbage executive James Galante. Why would you indict a garbage executive? For conspiring with New York gangsters to monopolize the garbage business in western Connecticut and upstate New York? Joe Lieberman got contributions for his presidential campaign from him. And, ladies and gentlemen, in the buried lead department, the good news, trumpeted by the feds this week, is that attacks by insurgents and other fighters in Iraq have gone down, according to the Government Accountability Office new report. Buried at the end of the Washington Post's report on this, the GAO noted that, according to the Defense Intelligence Agency, military reporting on attacks does not account for all the violence in Iraq. The military, quote, may underreport incidents of Shia militias fighting each other and attacks against Iraqi security forces, where there are few coalition forces present, and in southern Iraq, and where the U.S. military has reported escalating violence in recent months. So it's down, but not that kind of down. Hello, welcome to the show. From the Lakeside Studios of WWNO-FM, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Hey, Pakistan's heated up, huh? Now, I just want to clarify, ladies and gentlemen, because I have been on something of a thing about Pakistan ever since the run-up to the Iraq War. And the point was not to necessarily poke fingers at Pakistan. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to be right now, I'm sure. Under a state of emergency, but basically just to say that the media and these, I'm going to use a term of art here, the opposition party in the debate about the Iraq War before it started kept doing what the Bush administration did, which was acting as if Iraq was the only country in the world that you had to pay attention to. And all the questions about Iraq were, if you answered them in the affirmative, then you went to war. And if you answered them in the negative, then you didn't. But nobody ever said, but wait, there are other countries. We might compare the Iraq situation to those and see, you know. So here's this place with nuclear weapons and terrorist havens, and which has invaded its neighbor. And we just, and that was the country we decided was our friend. And now here we are in a situation that the New York Times describes today as, in terms of experts, quoting experts as saying, this could be the Bush administration's worst nightmare coming true. At which point I can just say, now they know how it feels. Let's check in on the negotiating session. Okay, I think they're making, they're getting to know each other a little bit. Speaking of Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. right before the emergency was declared accused the mainstream U.S. media of getting the story all wrong about Pakistan. None of their information is correct, he said. We are more than victims of terrorism, but there are people who don't believe us. Pakistan has become a fall guy for all the bad things happening in the neighborhood. He did concede that Pakistan was, quote, in bed with the Taliban when they were governing Afghanistan for an excellent reason. We always supported the government in Kabul. Irrespective of who it was. But that's history now. We gave that up after 9/11 when we made a 180-degree switch because we found that was in our interest. The interview took place at Pakistan's $17 million embassy in Washington. The ambassador said Pakistan has almost licked al-Qaeda after the 9/11 attacks, but, quote, everything changed after the U.S. invaded Iraq, reviving al-Qaeda. All right, let's turn to Iraq, because it's so darn much fun. Guess who's back? Ahmad Chalabi. Now, if this guy, if the New Orleans mayor showed up as frequently as Ahmad Chalabi, New Orleans would be in much better shape. Ahmad Chalabi, the controversial, ubiquitous Iraqi politician, and one-time Bush administration favorite, this is from McClatchy newspapers, has reemerged as a central figure in the latest U.S. strategy for Iraq. That's got to be a good strategy if it revolves around Ahmad Chalabi, don't you think? He was the guy who, I believe, supplied Curveball to us. Who's going to be on 60 Minutes? Curveball. Never too late. His new job, Chalabi's, is to press... Curveball was the single source for information on Iraq's WMDs that the U.S. relied upon, even though the CIA said repeatedly he was not trustworthy. Well, that's good enough for me. His latest job, Chalabi's, is to press Iraq's central government to use the security gains from the surge to deliver better electricity, health, education, and local security services to Baghdad neighborhoods. That's phase two of the surge plan. I wish we'd been told when the surge began that phase two revolved around Ahmad Chalabi. That would have made it more interesting. That the U.S. and Iraqi officials are again turning to Chalabi, this time to restore life to Baghdad neighborhoods, according to McClatchy newspapers, speaks to his resiliency in the government. It's also, some say, his latest effort to promote himself as a true national advocate for everyday Iraqis. Iraqis yearn for someone who can help make the government help them. The key is going to be getting the concerned local citizens feeling that this government is reconnected with them, says General Petraeus. Chalabi agrees with that. Why would he disagree? Earlier this month, Prime Minister Maliki named Chalabi as head of the Services Committee. Chalabi is an important part of the process, says Petraeus' spokesman. He has a lot of energy. He's also, I believe, under a $25 million penalty for not corruption. Something like corruption in connection with his banking business. Jordan found him guilty in absentia and fined him $25 million. But, you know, he's not in Jordan, and he has a lot of energy. Petraeus traveled last week to Arab Jabur. That's a Baghdad neighborhood with Chalabi. During the trip, a local military colonel described where he wants to see a new health care facility. Chalabi asked, "Where is the health ministry in this?" Petraeus replied, "That's your job." Ahmad Chalabi to the rescue, ladies and gentlemen, because Jim Dandy wasn't available. Other reports about Iraq come this week from the Office of the Special Inspector General. Have we not gotten rid of him yet? What a pest. He found little of the reconstruction effort has succeeded in proving the Mosul Dam. That's a dam we learned this week could breach and drown the city of Mosul. The Army Corps of Engineers is hard at work. That should help the people of Mosul breathe a little easier. Anyway, the Inspector General reviewed contracts. A Turkish company was paid about more than $500,000 to build storage silos for cement, had done so little and such poor quality work that its project may have to be restarted. One company contracted to design grout mixing plants instead submitted plants for unusable concrete mixing plants. High-tech equipment meant to help grouting is gathering dust because it won't work. Army Corps officials say it has been difficult to conduct oversight of the project because it's in a dangerous area. Security is better, but we can't do oversight on the dam because it's still dangerous. They said contracts with the worst businesses have been terminated. and steps have been taken to ensure better management of the project. Said the Inspector General, our focus is on whether the project the Corps undertook got carried out, and the answer to that question is no. The expenditures of the money have yielded no benefit yet. That's the Army Corps in Iraq, but hard at work on the Mosul Dam. And attention, Mr. Chalabi, you do have your work cut out for you. Iraq's electricity output has reached a new high, but the country's reconstruction effort lags in oil production, manufacturing, and basic services. This also from the Inspector General. It also criticized U.S. involvement in Iraq's development for lacking a central plan for helping to deliver essential services. Well, we got that plan now. It's called Chalabi. Iraq's unemployment is still running as high as 40%. Power production still meets only 60% of national demand, well below a 6,000-megawatt production goal set in 2003 by the Coalition Provisional Authority. Well, that was Paul Bremer. What did he know? He wanted them to have electricity. He's a dreamer. He was a dreamer. You know what, ladies and gentlemen? I think it's time for... That's enough news about Iraq, it seems to me. Of course, I would say that if we had just had the one story about Chalabi. But I think it's time for news from outside the bubble. Yes, it's a copyrighted feature. And thank you for asking. Oh, a leaked British Army report has delivered an unprecedented attack on the planning and execution of the war in Iraq. The document, which openly condemns British and U.S. foreign policy, says that, quote, leaders should not start an operation without thinking through the options and implications of their plans, unquote. That's good advice. Never too late. The leaked British Army document claims that widespread planning failures in the post-war phase led to the peace in Iraq being lost by September 2003, within the first 100 days of the occupation. The rest is gravy. The report, marked restricted, adds that many senior Army officers in Britain now believe that the government has developed a, quote, bureaucratic approach to problem-solving and is no longer capable of running large-scale military operations such as Iraq and Afghanistan. That's the British government. Ours is much better. The document describes how the Iraq campaign was undermined by a lack of planning, resources, funding, and intelligence. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it's a good war. The evidence shows that too little planning was done, particularly on the non-military side, and that too few resources, both human and financial, were allocated to the post-war situation. The report was drawn up a year ago, and it suggests that Britain and the U.S. may have breached the Geneva Convention by failing properly to conduct their duties as occupying powers. It says assessments by British commanders on the success of their reconstruction efforts were, quote, hopelessly optimistic. The secrecy surrounding the invasion, the report claims, meant that British government departments were unable to plan for the post-war phase until December 2002, just 3 months before the start of the invasion. The report makes no apology for the stark criticism contained within it, nor for the embarrassment it will cause the government. It does say the Army has a duty to learn from experience. The report says the main focus of U.S. commanders was the stabilization of Baghdad, and they were unresponsive to the concerns of their British counterparts for the worsening situation in southern Iraq. And one officer wrote that Britain was committed to an ideologically driven U.S. timetable, adding, quote, the train was on Grand Central Station and was leaving at a time which we did not control. The multinational headquarters suffered from a lack of good quality British officers with formal staff training. The British were unable to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqis because they failed to understand Arab culture. British had been there before, ladies and gentlemen, unlike us, in the 1920s. One officer wrote, we may be able to influence their minds, but we will never win the Islamic heart. The Army must do more to gain tolerance and depart from the country before intolerance sets in. One officer who contributed to this secret report said, we couldn't begin planning until it was almost too late. We just didn't have enough time, so we went to war on untested plans. A spokesman for the Ministry of Defense in Britain said, quote, we don't comment on leaked documents. I'd say that's a good policy, given the circumstances. And also from McClatchy newspapers, the retired general who served as President Bush's special envoy to deal with the Kurdistan Workers' Party says the United States has failed to keep its promises to Turkey to confront that Kurdish terrorist group, and Turkey may feel it has no choice but to attack the sanctuary in northern Iraq. So let's just review. The government for which terrorism is supposedly its first priority has relaxed regulations on chemicals that terrorists could use, and it's failing to keep its promises to Turkey on controlling a terrorist group in Iraq which is attacking Turkey. This is retired Air Force General Joseph Ralston. Declined to say why he stepped down a few weeks ago, but published reports say he was frustrated by the Bush administration's failure to act against the PKK. He says now the United States is unwittingly driving the Turks and the Iranians together because both nations share concerns about violent Kurdish separatist groups. The Turks and the Iranians, they got a good thing going on.
In a little while from now, if I'm not feeling any less sour, I promise myself to treat myself and go visit a nearby tower. And climbing to the top, I could throw myself off in an effort to make it clear to who what it's like when you're shattered, left standing in the lurch of the church, where the people are saying, my God, that's so tough, she stood him up. No point in us remaining, we may as well go home. As I did on my own, alone again, naturally. Think that all along the way I was cheerful, bright and gay, and I was looking forward to, well, wouldn't you, the role I was about to play. And as if to knock me down, reality came around without so much as a mere touch. It broke me into tiny pieces, left leaving me doubt the power of the Lord God Almighty. And if he really does exist, why the hell did he desert me in my hour of need? I surely am indeed alone again, naturally. Too many people in this world with broken hearts that can't be mended, left unattended. What can we do? Do-do-do. All through the years, everything else that appears, I remember I cried when my daddy died, never wishing to hide these tears. He was 65 years old, and my mama, God rest her soul, she couldn't understand why the only man she'd ever loved had
have been taken, leaving her to cope with a heart so badly broken, without a single word from me. No words were ever spoken. And when she passed away, I cried and cried all day, alone again, alone again, alone again. Naturally,
this is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, time for News of the Warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we can. Deadline Duluth, like ice sheets melting in the Arctic, Lake Superior has begun showing some of the world's most tangible evidence of global warming, according to scientists gathered in Duluth this week. The lake's average winter ice cover is 50% smaller than it was 100 years ago.
What's that going to do to the Father Emil going ice fishing, do you think?
I don't know. Since 1980, the water on average in summer has warmed almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade, which is twice as fast as the air has warmed. During that time, wind speeds in the middle of the lake have also risen steadily. In many ways, you and the Lake Superior Basin are the canary in the coal mine, says the senior climatologist at Environment Canada. Lake Superior is really one of the early victims of climate change. It's changing its name to Lake Inferior in honor of the event. Greenland appears to be floating upwards. Its landmass is rising up to 4 centimeters each year, scientists quoted in New Scientist magazine now revealed. And the country's newfound buoyancy is a symbol of Greenland's shrinking ice cap, they add. The earth is elastic, and if you put a load on top of it, then the surface will move down. If you remove the load, the surface starts rising again, says Shfakat Khan of the Danish National Space Center. These Danish names, they're so hard to pronounce. In the case of Greenland, the load is its ice cap, he says. Such uplift is not an unknown phenomenon. Raised beaches are relatively common in some areas where the loss of ice after the last ice age caused the land to rise. Khan and his team detected Greenland's uplift. Pleasing uplift. Using measurements from GPS stations located on the bedrock underneath the ice. Uplift on the bedrock. Before 2004, the uplift was about 0.5 centimeter to 1 centimeter per year, he told New Scientist. Since then, the land has been rising 4 times faster. This means that since 2004, Greenland has been losing 4 times more ice than before. And according to The Guardian newspaper in London, empty shelves in Caracas, food riots in West Bengal and Mexico, warnings of hunger in Jamaica, Nepal and the Philippines and sub-Saharan Africa, soaring prices for basic foods are beginning to lead to political instability, with governments being forced to step in to artificially control across the bread, corn, rice and dairy products. Record world prices for most foods have led to 18% food price inflation in China, 13% in Indonesia and Pakistan. I don't think food's their problem right now. Wheat has doubled in price. Corn is nearly 50% higher than a year ago. Rice is 20% more expensive, says the UN. The price rises are a result of record oil prices, U.S. farmers switching out of food crops to grow biofuel crops, extreme weather, and growing demand from India and China. So, global fuel crisis, thanks to climate change, perhaps. Although, one listener wrote a very thoughtful response during the week to the piece about the report I shared with you last week about the researcher connecting the removal of lead from our ambient environment with the decrease in crime. It says it's It's interesting, but it's not causative. Well, okay. All right. I'll take that. I'm, you know, I'm no scientist, but I play one on the radio. That's all I can say. Ladies and gentlemen, from the, that was news of the warm, wasn't it? Just went by like that. The number of foreign visitors to the United States has plummeted since 9/11 because foreigners don't feel welcome. This is the French news agency quoting tourism professionals. French news agency, ladies and gentlemen. Since September 11, 2001, the United States has experienced a 17% decline in overseas travel, costing America $94 billion in lost visitor spending, nearly 200,000 jobs, and $16 billion in tax revenue, says Discover America, which is an outfit trying to promote tourism, I guess. Chairman Stephen Porter lamented the extraordinary decline in the number of overseas visitors to the United States. The group's executive director blamed the slump on the shabby welcome many foreigners feel they get in the United States. Quote, it's clear what's keeping people away is the perception around the world that travelers aren't welcome, said executive director Jeff Freeman. Travelers around the world, he says, feel the U.S. entry experience is among the world's worst. All right, we're not the worst. Burma might be ahead of us. Although, Freeman called on the U.S. government to work with the private sector to make visa acquisition more efficient, the entry process traveler-friendly, and improve communication. You know, if those foreign travelers were only chemical companies, they'd have a much easier time with these regulations. The greatest public diplomacy tool America has is her people, says the advocacy group. Well, maybe. The senior State Department official in charge of public diplomacy has just resigned. Longtime Bush aide, friend, consultant, supporter, Karen Hughes, all the way back to the Texas days, was named by President Bush as the head of public diplomacy in the State Department a couple of years ago. And here's her report on how things have gone under her stewardship.
I feel that I've done what Secretary Rice and President Bush asked me to do by transforming public diplomacy and making it a national security priority central to everything we do in government.
Which is to say, you know, don't ask me why they hate us. Don't ask me why they don't feel welcome. Don't ask me why the public opinion polls look the way they do over there. And yet, I'm going to ask her.
Karen, do they love us again? Do they see Uncle Sam as their friend? Do their hearts swell with pride, knowing God's on our side? Is this whole hatred thing on the mend? Karen, do they like us some more? Do they ask for our stuff at the store? When they watch their TV, do they yearn to be free and decide to sign up for a war? Oh, there was no greater Bushy than Karen P. Hughes. Always knew how to make him look good on the news. With the whole world to win and nothing to what they both wished, another mission accomplished. Did she put out the fire or relight the fuse? Karen, do they know that we're good, like you promised that you knew that they would? Have you banished their fear? Do
they want to come here as if they actually could? Karen, do they admit that we're nice? That we're just trying to build paradise? Have you got them convinced they were wrong to have winced? We invaded their place once or twice. Was there ever a player like Karen B. Hughes? Knew what buttons to push and just who to confuse? Her slightest suggestion you could not refuse. Though she stood right at the nexus of everything Texas, even Condi had to smile and follow her cues. They finally confessed that we're the ones they like best. To our goals, are they ready to swear? Karen, ooh, you did more than your share. Thank you.
and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yes, here they are. Dave, first of all, this week's gay Republican in action. Pardon me. Dateline Spokane, Washington. Washington State Representative Richard Curtis resigned amid allegations he had sex with a man who threatened to go public about the lawmaker's gay lifestyle if the man weren't paid $1,000. Curtis released a statement saying, "While I believe I've done some good and helped a lot of people during the time I served in the legislature, events have recently come to light that have hurt a lot of people. I sincerely apologize for any pain my actions may have caused. This has been damaging to my family. And I don't want to subject them to any additional pain that might result from carrying out this matter under the public scrutiny that comes with holding public office." Maybe it's the gay party. The A&E television network has suspended production of the Hawaii-based reality show Dog the Bounty Hunter after its star Dwayne Dog Chapman was caught on an audio tape repeatedly using a racial slur. The tape was obtained by the National Enquirer. On the tape, Chapman uses the N-word in reference to his son's black girlfriend. Well, that's twice as nice. In a statement issued from Honolulu, Chapman said, "My sincerest heartfelt apologies go out to every person I have offended for my regrettable use of very inappropriate language. I am deeply disappointed in myself for speaking out of anger to my son and using such a hateful term in a private phone conversation. It was completely taken out of context. I was disappointed in his choice of a friend, not due to her race, but her character. However, I should never have used that term. I have the utmost respect and aloha for black people who have already suffered so much. I did not mean to add yet another slap in the face to an entire race of people who have brought so many gifts to the world. I am ashamed of myself, and I pledge to do whatever I can to repair this damage I have caused." Well, that's an apology. He continues, "In Hawaii, we have something called Ha'oponopono, where people come together to resolve crises and restore peace and balance. I am meeting with my spiritual advisor." He's playing the Hawaii card. Oprah Winfrey profusely apologized to the parents of students at her all-girls school in South Africa for a sex abuse scandal that resulted in the dismissal of one of the dormitory matrons. "I've disappointed you. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry," a tearful Winfrey told angry families. I guess to be a success in afternoon TV, you have to cry. They showed up at an emergency meeting at the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls. Montel, start crying. Quick. Allegations surfaced 2 weeks ago that a dorm parent had been accused of fondling a girl and physically and verbally abusing several others, including grabbing them about the neck, beating them, and hurling them against a wall. Winfrey suspended the matron, at least one other staffer. The school's principal was placed on paid administrative leave. "I trusted her," Winfrey told the families regarding the principal. "I've been disappointed." Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says he apologized to his Turkish counterpart last week for possibly violating Turkey's airspace. Remarks were the closest the Israeli leader has come to commenting about that mysterious Israeli airstrike on Syria. Olmert described the apology during a meeting with his cabinet. He told the Turkish Prime Minister that if Israeli planes did enter Turkish airspace, it was not done deliberately. Israel, of course, has given no details of the raid. It hasn't even acknowledged officially carrying it out. Hey, the Don't Tase Me Bro guys made the apologies of the week. Andrew Meyer has apologized to University of Florida students, as well as the president of the university, for his failure to act calmly during that September meeting with Senator John Kerry. Meyer wrote that he stepped out of line and felt he had tarnished the university's image. "For that, again, I am truly sorry," Meyer wrote. He has withdrawn from classes since the Don't Tase Me Bro episode. He plans to return in January. He has accepted punishment from the University of Florida for violating the student code of conduct. I guess they prohibit being tased. The chief of the voting rights section of the Justice Department, John Tanner, has apologized for saying earlier this month that, quote, "minorities don't become elderly the way white people do. They die first," unquote. The apology went out to attendees of the National Latino Congress, where Tanner made the remarks originally. In the letter, Tanner does not recant his analysis that voter ID laws discriminate against whites, but does apologize that his explanation of the data came across in a hurtful way. Yahoo has apologized for failing to provide full information to U.S. lawmakers investigating the case of a Chinese cyber dissident imprisoned by Beijing. Lou Dobbs is sorry about calling New York Governor Eliot Spitzer an idiot. A British Parliament member has apologized for comparing a government agreement to one with Hitler. Apologized to British Foreign Minister David Miliband for his offensive remark comparing the British government's stance on the European Union Treaty to Neville Chamberlain's coming back to Britain from Munich. Miliband, the son of a Belgian Holocaust refugee, said he had been cut to his very quick by the comments from Michael Connerty. Connerty replied, "They are your sensitivities, not mine," after he apologized. A Florida theme park is apologizing to a St. John's, Newfoundland woman who was told to cover up while she breastfed her daughter or leave the premises. That's Universal Studios Park in Orlando. I guess they don't have a breastfeeding ride. The BBC has apologized for a remark by its Radio 2 morning host, Sarah Kennedy, in which she said she almost hit a pedestrian in the dark because he was black. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program concludes, returns, is what it does, next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Radio, up and down the northeast, well, the whole east coast of North America on WBCQ, the planet, on Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world on the internet, two different locations whenever you want it, on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download at www.audible.com/the show, available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the Mexican government saying everybody who helped the victims of Hurricane Katrina should help the victims of the floods in Tabasco, and not looking at the U.S. federal government when they say that. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Just, you know, to avoid disappointment. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego Pittsburgh desks and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO-FM here in New Orleans. Playlists? Email address for this broadcast, harryshearer.com, and I'll see you during the week at mydamnchannel.com. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.